Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Book 11, Chapter 7 of Brothers Karamazov, and then reading Chapter 8. Again, what's happening between Smurdy and Ivan? Did Ivan make room for the murder to happen? And what do you think of the drunk letter? I am Norwegian, said, ooh, Ivan's money is from the inheritance. That makes perfect sense. Ivan still isn't sure what happened. He's oscillating between being absolutely sure that Mitya did it, to thinking that maybe Smurdy did it, to thinking that either way he himself is guilty. It is a little confusing, as their tug of war about where the guilt lies is based on a conversation where none of the things they are arguing about were actually said. It was all insinuation and undertones. Then you add Ivan's own uncertainty into the mix, and Smurdy's generally bizarre nature, and you have a recipe for a very disorienting conflict. The only thing I'm confused about is Churchmashnya. I was sure that I remembered that Ivan did not travel here, and instead went to Moscow. But in this chapter, Smurdy insinuates that he did go to Churchmashnya. Did I misinterpret something? Ivan did board the train, says Somerstars, and began to ride to Moscow. Then he realized partway there that he's a fool, if I recall correctly. His story cut off there, and it didn't ever confirm that he went all the way to Moscow. Ivan Norwegian said, I went back to check, and it is vague. Speaking to Smurdy, he said, you see, I am going to Churchmashnya, broke suddenly from Ivan. Again, as the day before, the words seemed to drop of themselves, and he laughed too, a peculiar, nervous laugh. He remembered it long after. Then he makes sure that to let his father and brothers know that he isn't going to Churchmashnya. And at last we're told that as Ivan's train approached Moscow, he felt like a scoundrel. I had forgot how despondent Smurdy was over being caught between Fyodor and Dmitri. Reading over the conversation again, it's almost like Smurdy is asking permission to kill Fyodor and frame Dmitri to both of their benefit. Tech Riffic said that that is his interpretation as well. That sort of surprised me, said Tech. I was under the impression that only Mitya, as the oldest, has any money coming. Oh, sorry, he's talking about Ivan's money coming from the inheritance. Surprised, he was under the impression that only Mitya, as the oldest, had any money coming. At least in the beginning, he acted as if he was the only one with any claim to Fyodor's estate and wealth. Maybe the Russian inheritance law was more like the Napoleonic one. I am Norwegian said, it was also mentioned pretty explicitly that Dmitri overestimated what was owed to him. There was an annotation in my translation that said that if you become a prisoner, you lost certain rights, inheritance being among them. Under either system, money split or all to the eldest, Ivan would benefit, though, since he is older than Alyosha. Okay, where am I up to here? Somerstar says, for question two, which was, did Ivan make room for the murder to happen? From a modern psychological perspective, if Smurdy did kill Fyodor, it is not Ivan's fault just because he left and or went to Churchmashnya. Smurdy is 100% responsible for his own actions, regardless of what others do or don't do. If Smurdy killed Fyodor, it's completely on him. For question three, which was, what do you think of the drunk letter? The letter certainly seems damning for Mitya, says Somerstars, but there's a possibility he was not being literal when he called himself a murderer. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, Katya dropped the bomb. It seems that Dmitri did it, or Dostoevsky is playing mind games with us. I don't know why Dmitri needs to inform everyone he feels everyone how he feels every minute. He wears his heart on his sleeve, and he is always sincere, bordering on rude. Okay, I understand him, but this letter is a first-class ticket to Siberia. Smerdyakov is the opposite. You never know what he thinks. He talks with half-truths, and what he says can be understood in different ways. Actually, Smurdy is twisting his conversations with Ivan. He is manipulating him, controlling his mind, playing with his feelings of guilt and unjustified fears. You need a lot of mental toughness to deal with a psychopath like him. Soma Stars said I almost posted the same thing about Smurdy's mind games, wrote it out, and then deleted it. Excuse me while I take a sip of a beer. Beery. Well, there you go. You should have posted it, Soma Stars. Don't censor yourself like that. Go for it. Do that. What Tech does every now and then, his unfiltered thoughts. By the way, Tech, give us some more of your unfiltered thoughts now and then. I really enjoy it when you do that. Right. Okay, mind games, you reckon? Yeah, I think Smurdy's not as dumb as he kind of plays it, right? He's a bit of a mastermind. Or is he dumb? I don't know. I'm actually on the fence about that guy. Let's read on and find out, hey? We stopped yesterday halfway through... Oh, no, we didn't. No, we didn't. We're going to stop today halfway through the chapter. Chapter 8. The third and last interview with Smurdyakov. When he was halfway there, the keen, dry wind that had been blowing early that morning rose again, and a fine, dry snow began falling thickly. It did not lie on the ground, but was whirled about by the wind, and soon there was a regular snowstorm. There were scarcely any lamp posts in the part of the town where Smurdyakov lived. Ivan strode alone in the darkness, unconscious of the storm, instinctively picking out his way. His head ached, and there was a painful throbbing in his temples. He felt that his hands were twitching convulsively. Not far from Marya Kondratyevna's cottage, Ivan suddenly came upon a solitary drunken little peasant. He was wearing a coarse and patched coat, and was walking in zigzags, grumbling and swearing to himself. Then he suddenly would begin singing in a husky, drunken voice, "Ach, Vanka's gone to Petersburg. I won't wait till he comes back." But he broke off every time at the second line and began swearing again. Then he would begin in the same song again. Ivan felt an intense hatred for him. He had thought about him at all. Before he had thought about him at all. Suddenly he realized his presence and felt an irresistible impulse to knock him down. At that moment they met, and the peasant with a violent lurch fell full tilt against Ivan, who pushed him back furiously. The peasant went flying backwards and fell like a log on the frozen ground. He uttered one plaintive, "Oh, oh," and then was silent. Ivan stepped up to him. He was lying on his back without movement or consciousness. "He will be frozen," thought Ivan, and he went on his way to Smurdyakov's. In the passage, Marya Kondratyevna, who ran out to open the door with a candle in her hand, whispered to Smurdyakov that Smurdyakov was very ill. "It's not that he's laid up, but he seems not himself, and he even told us to take the tea away. He wouldn't have any." "Why, does he make a row?" asked Ivan coarsely. "Oh dear, no, quite the contrary. He's very quiet. Only please don't talk to him too long," Marya Kondratyevna begged him. Ivan opened the door and stepped into the room. It was overheated as before, but there were changes in the room. One of the benches at the side had been removed, and in its place had been put a large old mahogany leather sofa, on which a bed had been made up, with fairly clean white pillows. Smurdyakov was sitting on the sofa, wearing the same dressing gown. The table had been brought out in front of the sofa so that there was hardly room to move. On the table lay a thick book in yellow cover, but Smurdyakov was not reading it. He seemed to be sitting, doing nothing. He met Ivan with a slow, silent gaze, and was apparently not at all surprised at his coming. There was a great change in his face. He was much thinner and sallower. His eyes were sunken, and there were blue marks under them. "Why, you really are ill," Ivan stopped short. "I won't keep you long. I won't even take my coat off. Where can one sit down?" He went to the other end of the table, moved up a chair, and sat down on it. "Why do you look at me without speaking? We only come with one question, and I swear I won't go without an answer. Has the young lady, Katerina Ivanovna, been with you?" Smurdyakov still remained silent, looking quietly at Ivan as before. Suddenly, with a motion of his hand, he turned his face away. "What's the matter with you?" cried Ivan. "Nothing." "What do you mean by nothing?" "Yes, she has. It's no matter to you. Leave me alone." "No, I won't let you alone. Tell me, when was she here?" "Why, I'd quite forgotten about her," said Smurdyakov with a scornful smile. and turning his face to Ivan, he stared at him with a look of frenzied hatred, the same look that he had fixed on him at their last interview a month before. "You seem very ill yourself. Your face is sunken. You don't look like yourself," he said to Ivan. "Never mind my health. Tell me what I asked you." "But why are your eyes so yellow? The whites are quite yellow." "Are you so worried?" He smiled contemptuously and suddenly laughed outright. "Listen, I've told you I won't go away without an answer," Ivan cried, intensely irritated. "Why do you keep pestering me? Why do you torment me?" said Smerdyakov with a look of suffering. "Damn it, I've nothing to do with you. Just answer my question and I'll go away." "I have no answer to give you," said Smerdyakov, looking down again and sipping his beer. "You may be sure I'll make you answer." "Why are you so uneasy?" Smerdyakov stared at him, not simply with contempt, but almost with repulsion. "Is this because the trial begins tomorrow? Nothing will happen to you. Can't you believe that at last? Go home, go to bed, and sleep in peace. Don't be afraid of anything." "I don't understand you. What am I to be afraid of tomorrow?" Ivan articulated in astonishment, and suddenly a chill breath of fear did in fact pass over his soul. Smerdyakov measured him with his eyes. "You don't understand," he drawled reproachfully. "It's a strange thing a sensible man should care to play such a farce." Ivan looked at him, speechless. The startling, incredibly supercilious tone of this man, who had once been his valet, was extraordinary in itself. He had not taken such a tone even at their last interview. "I tell you, you've nothing to be afraid of. I won't say anything about you. There's no proof against you. I say how your hands are trembling. Why are your fingers moving like that? Go home. You did not murder him." Ivan started. He remembered Alyosha. "I know it was not I," he faltered. "Do you?" Smerdyakov caught him up again. Ivan jumped up and seized him by the shoulder. "Tell me everything, you viper. Tell me everything." Smerdyakov was not in the least scared. He only riveted his eyes on Ivan with insane hatred. "Well, it was you who murdered him, if that's it," he whispered furiously. Ivan sank back on his chair as though pondering something. He laughed malignantly. "You mean my going away, what you talked about last time? You stood before me last time and understood it all, and you understand it now. All I understand is that you are mad. Aren't you tired of it? Here we are, face to face. What's the use of going on keeping up a farce to each other? Are you still trying to throw it all on me, to my face? You murdered him. You are the real murderer. I was only your instrument, your faithful servant, and it was following your words I did it." "Did it? Why did you murder him?" Ivan turned cold. Something seemed to give way in his brain, and he shuddered all over with a cold shiver. Then Smerdyakov himself looked at him wonderingly. Probably the genuineness of Ivan's horror struck him. "You don't mean to say you really did not know," he faltered mistrustfully, looking with a forced smile into his eyes. Ivan still gazed at him and seemed unable to speak. "Ah, Vanka's gone to Petersburg. I won't wait till he comes back," suddenly echoed in his head. "Do you know I am afraid you are a dream, a phantom sitting before me," he muttered. "There's no phantom here, but only us two and one another. No doubt he is here, that third between us." "Who is he? Who is here? What third person?" Ivan cried in alarm, looking about him. His eyes hastily searched in every corner. "That third is God himself, Providence. He is the third beside us now. Only don't look for him. You won't find him." "It's a lie that you killed him," Ivan cried madly. "You are mad or teasing me again." Smerdyakov, as before, watched him curiously with no sign of fear. He could still scarcely get over his incredulity. He still fancied that Ivan knew everything and was trying to throw it all on him to his face. "Wait a minute," he said at last in a weak voice, and suddenly bringing up his left leg from under the table, he began turning up his trouser leg. He was wearing long white stockings and slippers. Slowly he took off his garter and fumbled to the bottom of his stocking. Ivan gazed at him and suddenly shuddered in a paroxysm of terror. "He's mad," he cried, and rapidly jumping up he drew back so that he knocked his back against the wall and stood up against it, stiff and straight. He looked with insane terror at Smerdyakov, who, entirely unaffected by his terror, continued fumbling in his stocking as though he were making an effort to get hold of something with his fingers and pull it out. At last he got hold of it and began pulling it out. Ivan saw that it was a piece of paper, or perhaps a roll of papers. Smerdyakov pulled it out and laid it on the table. "Here," he said quietly. "What is it?" asked Ivan, trembling. "Kindly look at it," Smerdyakov answered, still in the same low tone. Ivan stepped up to the table and took up the roll of paper and began unfolding it, but suddenly drew back his fingers as though from contact with a loathsome reptile. "Your hands keep twitching," observed Smerdyakov, and he deliberately unfolded the bundle himself. Under the wrapper were three packets of 100-ruble notes. "They are all here, all 3,000 rubles. You need not count them. Take them," Smerdyakov suggested to Ivan, nodding at the notes. Ivan sank back in his chair. He was as white as a handkerchief. "You frightened me with your stocking," he said, with a strange grin. "Can you really not have known till now?" Smerdyakov asked once more. "No, I did not know. I kept thinking of Dmitri. Brother, brother, ach." He suddenly clutched his head in both hands. "Listen, did you kill him alone? With my brother's help or without?" "It was only with you, with your help, that I killed him. And Dmitri Fyodorovitch is quite innocent." All right, talk about me later. Why do I keep on trembling? I can't speak properly." "You were bold enough then. You said everything was lawful, and how frightened you are now," Smerdyakov muttered in surprise. "Why do you have some lemonade? I'll ask for some at once. It's very refreshing, only I must hide this first." And again he motioned at the notes. He was just going to get up and call at the door to Maya Kondratievna to make some lemonade and bring it to them, but looking for something to cover up the notes that she might not see them, he first took out his handkerchief, and as it turned out to be very dirty, took up the big yellow book that Ivan had noticed at first lying on the table and put it over the notes. The book was The Sayings of the Holy Father Isaac the Syrian. Ivan read it mechanically. "I won't have any lemonade," he said. "Talk of me later. Sit down and tell me how you did it. Tell me all about it." "You'd better take off your great coat or you'll be too hot, Ivan." As though he'd only just thought of it, took off his coat and, without getting up from his chair, threw it on the bench. "Speak, please speak." He seemed calmer. He waited, feeling sure that Smerdyakov would tell him all about it. "How was it done?" sighed Smerdyakov. "It was done in a most natural way, following your very words." Oops, my screen just turned off. "Sorry. Following your very words." "Of my words later," Ivan broke in again, apparently with complete self-possession, firmly uttering his words and not shouting as before. "Only tell me in detail how you did it. Everything as it happened. Don't forget anything. The details, about everything. The details, I beg you." "You'd gone away, then I fell into the cellar." "In a fit or in a sham one?" "A sham one, naturally. I shammed it all. I went quietly down the steps to the very bottom and lay down quietly, and as I lay down I gave a scream and struggled till they carried me out." "Stay, and were you shamming all along afterwards and in the hospital?" "No, not at all. The next day, in the morning, before they took me to the hospital, I had a real attack, and a more violent one than I've had for years. For 2 days I was quite unconscious." All right, go on." "They laid me on the bed. I knew I'd be the other side of the partition for whenever I was ill. Marfa Ignatyevna used to put me near them. There, near them. She's always been very kind to me, from my birth up. At night I moaned, but quietly. I kept expecting Dmitri Fyodorovitch to come." "Expecting him to come to you?" "Not to me. I expected him to come into the house, for I'd no doubt that he'd come that night. For being without me and getting no news, he'd be sure to come and climb over the fence, as he used to, and do something." "And if he hadn't come?" "Then nothing would have happened. I should never have brought myself to it without him. All right, all right. Speak more intelligibly. Don't hurry. Above all, don't leave anything out. I expected him to kill Fyodor Pavlovich. I thought that was certain, for I had prepared him for it during the last few days. He knew about the knocks. That was the chief thing. With his suspiciousness and the fury which had been growing in him all those days, he was bound to get into the house by means of those taps. That was inevitable. So I was expecting him. Stay, Ivan interrupted. If he had killed him, he would have taken the money and carried it away. You must have considered that. What would you have got by it afterwards? I don't see. But he would never have found the money. That was only what I told him. That the money was under the mattress. But that wasn't true. It had been lying in a box. And afterwards I suggested to Fyodor Pavlovich, as I was the only person he trusted, to hide the envelope with the notes in the corner behind the icons. For no one would have guessed that place, especially if they came in a hurry. So that's where the envelope lay, in the corner behind the icons. It would have been absurd to keep it under the mattress. The box, anyway, could be locked. But all believe it was under the mattress, a stupid thing to believe. So if Dmitri Fyodorovich had committed the murder, finding nothing, he would either have run away in a hurry, afraid of every sound, as always happens with murderers, or he would have been arrested. So I could always have clambered up to the icons and have taken away the money next morning or even that night, and it would have all been put down to Dmitri Fyodorovich. I could reckon upon that. But what if he did not kill him, but only knocked him down? If he did not kill him, of course, I would not have ventured to take the money, and nothing would have happened. But I calculated that he would beat him senseless, and I should have time to take it then. And then I'd make out to Fyodor Pavlovich that it was no one but Dmitri Fyodorovich who had taken the money after beating him. Stop, I am getting mixed. Then it was Dmitri, after all, who killed him, not you only took the money. No, he didn't kill him. Well, I might as well have told you now that he was the murderer, but I don't want to lie to you now, because if you really haven't understood till now, as I see for myself, and are not pretending so as to throw your guilt on me to my very face, you are still responsible for it all, since you knew of the murder and charged me to do it, and went away knowing all about it. And so I want to prove to your face this evening that you are the only real murderer in the whole affair, and I am not the real murderer, though I did kill him. You are the rightful murderer. Why am I the murderer? Oh God, Ivan cried, unable to restrain himself at last, and forgetting that he had put off discussing himself till the end of the conversation. You still mean that Chechmeshnya? Stay, tell me, why did you want my consent if you really took Chechmeshnya for consent? How will you explain that now? Assured of your consent, I should have known that you wouldn't have made an outcry over those 3,000 being lost, even if I'd been suspected, instead of Dmitri Fyodorovich or as his accomplice. On the contrary, you would have protected me from others, and when you got your inheritance, you would have rewarded me when you were able, all the rest of your life, for you'd have received your inheritance through me, seeing that that if he had married Agrafena Alexandrovna, you wouldn't have had a farthing. Ah, then you intended to worry me all my life afterwards, snarled Ivan. And what if I hadn't gone away then, but had informed against you? What could you have informed? That I persuaded you to go to Chechmeshnya? That's all nonsense. Besides, after our conversation, you would either have gone away or have stayed. If you had stayed, nothing would have happened. I should have known that you didn't want it done, and should have attempted nothing. As you went away, it meant you assured me that you wouldn't dare to inform against me at the trial, and that you'd overlook my having the 3,000. And indeed, you couldn't have prosecuted me afterwards, because then I should have told it all in court. That is, not that I had stolen the money or killed him. I shouldn't have said that, but that you'd put me up to the theft and the murder, though I didn't consent to do it. That's why I needed your consent, so that you couldn't have cornered me afterwards. For what proof could you have had? I could always have cornered you, revealing your eagerness for your father's death, and I tell you the public would have believed it all, and you would have been ashamed for the rest of your life. Was I then so eager, was I? Ivan snarled again. To be sure, you were. And by your consent, you silently sanctioned my doing it. Smerdyakov looked resolutely at Ivan. He was very weak and spoke slowly and wearily, but some hidden inner force urged him on. He evidently had some design. Ivan felt that. Go on, he said. Tell me what happened that night. What more is there to tell? I lay there, and I thought I heard the master shout, and before that Grigory Vasilievich had suddenly got up and came out, and he suddenly gave a scream, and then all was silence and darkness. I lay there waiting, my heart beating. I couldn't bear it. I got up at last, went out. I saw the window open on the left into the garden, and I stepped to the left to listen whether he was sitting there alive, and I heard the master moving about, sighing, so I knew he was alive. Ech, I thought. I went to the window and shouted to the master, it's I, and he shouted to me, he's been, he's run away. He meant Dmitri Fyodorovitch had been. He's killed Grigory. Where? I whispered. There in the corner, he pointed. He was whispering too. Wait a bit, I said. I went to the corner of the garden to look, and there I came upon Grigory Vasilievich lying by the wall covered with blood, senseless. So it's true that Dmitri Fyodorovitch had been here, was the thought that came into my head, and I determined on the spot to make an end of it, as Grigory Vasilievich, even if he were alive, would see nothing of it, as he lay there senseless. The only risk was that Marfa Ignatyevna might wake up. I felt that at the moment, but the longing to get it done came over me till I could scarcely breathe. I went back to the window, to the master, and said, she's here, she's come, Agrafena Alexandra has come. She wants to be let in, and he started like a baby. Where is she? He fairly gasped, but couldn't believe it. She's standing there, I said, open. He looked out the window at me, half believing and half distrustful, but afraid to open. Why, he is afraid of me now, I thought, and it was funny. I bethought me to knock on the window frame. Those taps were agreed upon as the signal of Grushenka had come, in his presence before his eyes. He didn't seem to believe my word, but as soon as he heard the taps, he ran at once to open the door. He opened it. I would have gone in, but he stood in the way to prevent me passing. Where is she? Where is she? He looked at me, all of a tremble. Well, thought I, if he's so frightened of me as all that, it's a bad lookout. And my legs went weak with fright that he wouldn't let me in or would call out, or Marfa Ignatyevna would run up or something else might happen. I don't remember now, but I must have stood pale facing him. I whispered to him, why, she's there under the window. How is it you don't see her? I said. Bring her then, bring her. She's afraid, said I. She was frightened at the noise. She's hidden in the bushes. Go and call to her yourself from the study. He ran to the window, put the candle in the window. Grushenka, he cried. Grushenka, are you there? So he cried that he didn't want to lean out the window. He didn't want to move away from me, for he was panic-stricken. He was so frightened he didn't dare to turn his back on me. Why, here she is, said I. I went up to the window and leaned right out of it. Here she is. She's in the bush, laughing at you. Don't you see her? He suddenly believed it. He was all of a shake. He was awfully crazy about her, and he leaned right out of the window. I snatched up that iron paperweight from his table. Do you remember? Weighing about 3 pounds. I swung it and hit him on the top of the skull with the corner of it. He didn't even cry out. He only sank down suddenly, and I hit him again. And a third time. And a third time I knew I'd broken his skull. He suddenly rolled, on his back, face upwards, covered with blood. I looked round. There was no blood on me, not a spot. I wiped the paperweight, put it back, went up to the icons, took the money out of the envelope, and flung the envelope on the floor and the pink ribbon beside it. I went out into the garden, all of a tremble, straight to the apple tree with a hollow in it. You know, that hollow. I'd marked it long before and put a rag and a piece of paper ready in it. I wrapped all the notes in the rag and stuffed it deep down in the hole, and there it stayed for over a fortnight. I took it out later, when I came out of the hospital. I went back to my bed, lay down, and thought, if Grigory Vasilievich has been killed outright, it may be a bad job for me, and if he's not killed and recovers, it will be first rate. For then he'll bear witness that Dmitri Fyodorovich has been here, and so he must have killed him and taken the money. Then I began groaning with suspense and impatience, so as to wake Marfa Ignatyevna as soon as possible. At last she got up and she rushed to me, but when she saw Grigory Vasilievich was not there, she ran out, and I heard her screams in the garden, and that set it all going, and set my mind at rest. He stopped. All right, that's where we're going to stop for today. Thank you all very much for listening. Go over to the Reddit community, r/thehemingwaylist, have your say, and I will see you tomorrow.